So today is March 21st, 2015. This is another oral history interview session with Dr. Roald Hoffman. We're recording it here at the Chemical Heritage Foundation. I'm David Kruse. I'm here with Carsten Reinhardt. As I mentioned before we began, we're going to pick up where we left off. And at the end of the last session, we were talking about how you received the Nobel and the significance that it played for you as an individual. And the role that it played for the institution as well. Some of the things that you had mentioned were that, you know, Cornell was very excited about it, very happy to celebrate that. You enjoyed bringing family members to receive the award. But on an individual level, mostly what the award did for you was it gave you a chance to maybe receive grants a little more easily.
No, I didn't say that.
No? Okay.
It made me get more money for the same lecture I would have given before for less money.
Okay.
Grants didn't make easier. So maybe we talked about that on both grants and papers. It did not make things easier. If anything, it made things marginally harder. Mm-hmm. It would make it easier to publish a book which was science popularization of one type, but I somehow didn't seem to write those books, with the exception of one, the same and not the same. I don't mean to accent the negative, but I'm interested in destroying the journalistic myth of what the Nobel Prize is, which is first that it's a surprise, which is bizarre, because especially in science, it is a surprise in literature and in peace, but for totally the wrong reasons. That is, in literature because it's only given to one person and because it represents the peculiarities of the 18-member Swedish Academy, who have each their own favorite writer and who also prefer to recognize people from less well-known countries if they can. And the Peace Prize is a matter of other politics. I mean, I love President Obama, but to give the Peace Prize to President Obama when they did was bizarre and made his life harder. But in science, of course we know who is good. We know what work is good. We get invitations to lectures, we get invitations to everywhere, and the work is recognized, and it never is a surprise in science. Some of the people on it that they add on may be a surprise sometimes, but it isn't. But the reason the journalists want it to be a surprise, they want to, anyway, let's not stress on that. The other thing is at work is in part of my thing, I'm interested in deconstructing a mystique of chemists as, or of scientists as being superior to other human beings, because I don't feel superior. Being smarter, more ethical, more logical, all of those. Those are learned things, and they're important. But what happens is there is in science, as we know, an investigation of any field. There are contentions, there are personalities, there are typical human qualities. The miracle, this is not a falling into a social construction of science, that science, let me exaggerate, fire robin, that it's a power ploy to that anything goes. And it's not that. On the other hand, there are human beings, and the miracle of science is that something gets done about advancing reliable knowledge when it's done by fallible people such as scientists are. And it's the system that works overall, which is quite remarkable. Part of them being fallible human beings is they're jealous or envious or some combination of that. And a Nobel Prize engenders, because of the mystique attached to it, engenders a coming out of this. You can see this in, for instance, after the prize came on MRI, that there were some people who were slighted. There were advertisements, there are campaigns out there for some person who was not recognized. People are jealous. So where does that jealousy come out? Comes out. Freud would tell us where it comes out. It comes out in the dark. And the dark is the refereeing process in newspaper, on articles, and on what's worse is on research proposals, because there is no recourse by and large. So you would get comments like, I would make a mistake in a paper, but instead of saying the author has made a mistake, this is not right, or failed to cite this, you get comments like, I would not expect a Nobel laureate to be so stupid. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what is happening there? What is happening there? That person is unhappy with me, and it's coming out. So what's the purpose of the program director or the editor of the journal is to filter those out and forget about them. But sometimes it's difficult. I lost all my NSF funding at some point, quite a bit after the Nobel Prize, on the basis of two such negative comments. One was about outreach, a set person saying, so I was taking the NSF criterion of a broader interest, literally, and I devoted a good part of my proposal to the Entertaining Science Cabaret in New York City. And one of the reviewers said that Dr. Hoffman's, that somebody should think, didn't say Nobel laureate, that this is of any relevance to his doing science is beyond understanding. I mean, they're nasty comments. Yeah. So I'm used to nasty comments, but actually it had an effect. I lost the funding for 2 years. I regained it. The effect of Nobel Prize is also that you can change your career in several different ways. One is, and maybe I should have done that, is to try to get some people to support an institute for your research. One of the reasons that's good, that's what happened to Fukui, my co-author, my co-winner of the Nobel Prize. There was a research in Japan. I have very tight retirement rules of retirement age 60 to 63. And the way to bypass that, people go to private universities, don't have them, but Fukui, there was an institute for him, a private institute from private donations, and he went to work there. There are analogs in the United States with institute that Edelman has on memory and the brain. There is a few other things like that that could have been done. Another direction to go is into university administration or other public thing. I was asked to apply for the presidency of MIT, and that was the best of the several places. So that could have been a direction to go, but I wasn't interested. Mm-hmm. As far as publishing outside of science, except for popular science, it makes no difference. The world of poetry and theater is totally immune to the Nobel Prize in chemistry, except that if you get the thing accepted, a poem, or then they shift into the context of advertising or marketing. So they want you to mention the Nobel Prize on the back cover of the book or something like that. That's natural. But it doesn't help getting it published, getting it accepted, publication. Mm-hmm. Now, mind you, when I submit a poem for publication, you write a little cover letter and you send it to a journal. I do write it on chemistry department stationery. Now I can't do it really through the electronic submission so much. The reason I'm doing that is because I know what's going on. The typical journal is put out by an English department at some university, say University of Mississippi. There is Mississippi Review. And it's really run by graduate students in English who each read every day. So there are many more people who write poetry than buy poetry magazines. So there isn't an interesting economics. So lots of people submit. These poor graduate students read 50 poems a day, and I select two or three for the editor to read. And so 1,000 poems get filtered into 15, 20. So my direct audience, I know in general, not always, is that poor graduate student. So I will do anything reasonable to at least make them read the poem. So if I write this cover letter on chemistry department stationery, at least they'll wonder, what is that, where is that, why is that coming from the chemistry department? That's not where we usually get poems from. So that's all I'm working on.
So I know that, well, I'm curious to know a couple of things. When did you start to invest more time into things like poetry? I know you have books coming out in the 90s and thereafter.
That's right.
But I'm curious to know when that was an exploration. That
yes, so I began to write the poetry, it was before the Nobel Prize, mm-hmm. not too long before, but it was in midlife. It was around 1976 or so. I had been exposed at college to poetry and loved it by a great teacher, Mark Van Doren, and I knew a poet I had mentioned, Archie Ammons, a little bit somehow socially at Cornell. And I think I was encouraged, so this was 5 years before the Nobel Prize. Around, at that point I wasn't writing any semi-popular articles either. I was not writing anything. So first of all, overall, the line is not the Carl Sagan line, which is from science. So Carl Sagan was at Cornell, so that was an exemplar or a model one could have gone. So he went from science to popularizing science to books of that type, plus, of course, television program, and then wrote a novel. A $2 million advance didn't hurt on Contact, the only novel he wrote. Mm-hmm. I think he was working on another one, but I haven't heard anything about it. That was, in my case, the line was poetry, then popular science, writing for general audience and lecturing. And then the theater, so that was my connection. I sort of filled in the popular science, the ground in between the science, creative writing. I started writing around 77, I was 40 years old. I don't know why I hadn't written. I thought that because I was good at scientific writing, and I was also good at teaching introductory chemistry. Those two things actually in my mind are connected with each other, and I've written a little about how the usual equation of good research makes good teaching. It actually, for me, is inverted. I think good teaching makes good research. Mm. But people disagree on that. I felt that I could, in a poem, communicate things that I couldn't in a scientific paper, but the teaching helped me it wasn't a real program. It was just a feeling that I could do it. Part of it was that I think the key to good teaching is twofold, and it's somewhat connected to the key to good scientific research writing, at least. The two elements are empathy to the audience, so that you feel the level of understanding of the audience. That's in a class of 1,000, which is the largest class that we had. The lecture would only hold, room would only hold 400, so the lecture had to be repeated 3 times in our case. The magic of the teaching act is you can talk to several audiences at once. And I think I understand psychologically pieces of it. The several audiences are the people who understand everything you say. The people who are asleep, they don't hear, but the ones who don't understand a thing and everything in between. And you're one person. The words come out of your mouth. What Derrida would call the message that abandons. And out there it comes. So I think the reason it works is because not everyone is listening to every word. Mm-hmm. And they hear what they want to hear. So this is in part a deconstructionist attitude toward the teaching process. So that this, if you say something that communicates to the ones who know everything, you can say something else that's too simple. You can never be too simple, I think. Anyway, one thing is empathy. The other thing is there has to be some, and this is related to the poetry, there has to be some action on the part of the teacher that communicates an emotional involvement in the teaching process, that the student feel that the teacher cares that he or she understand, without making them feel bad about not understanding, but that they care, that it's a human being talking and not just reading from a book. That emotional contact is, one learns, good teachers learn how to establish that. You don't do it by looking at the same student all the time while you're talking. All you succeed is making them feel uncomfortable. But you shift your gaze, but you look at faces. But also, there are various hints you can drop of your humanity and its intersection with their humanity. Various things you can do. It's much harder to do that than writing a scientific paper. Much harder, especially given the gatekeepers and 150 years of tradition of the way papers are written. But I try to do that. And I have various little strategies for doing that. But to get back to the poetry, I felt I was good at this establishing an emotional tie with a student. I felt that I could do that in a poem, where the emotional tie is more important, perhaps, than anything else that you establish. That poem, many poems fail because they are too hermetic. They don't, the experience of the poet does not communicate to the experience of the reader. You can't always reach the high tone that's there in a Rilke quotation that I had at the end of the talk. The Duino elegies, where that came from, is not everyone reacts positively to those these days, but they are emotion at a very high level.
What was the first language you used in writing?
English.
English.
I could only write in English. By that time, the other languages had faded, so Polish and Yiddish were my native languages, but English was took over. I let it take over, and I'm not too proud about losing those two languages. I've kept a little of them. And then other languages, I think we may have talked about that, I don't know, but Russian and Swedish came in, and German, so I can talk in those, but I can't write in those.
You mentioned two poets as teachers and some influence.
Yes.
Have you had others?
The poet I read who was a major influence was the mid-20th century great poet Wallace Stevens, and it was in Mark Van Doren's course that a Wallace Stevens poem, Sunday morning, made sort of an impact. That was the first poem that really meant something to me.
Why?
It just the tone, and it talked about this woman on a Sunday morning looking at some oranges and feeling the world in there. It somehow meant something to me. There is a weird other set of poems which had an influence for me in my first year of college. These are the poems that are in Carmina Burana by Karl Orff, okay? But I went back and learned some Latin in order to read the original. And they're written in a mixture of, so these are, if you don't know these are poems that were found at a secularized Benedictine monastery in Bavaria, in Benediktbeuern. And there was a copy of secular ribald poems circulating on between the monks, found in a library there, well handled, circulating for 500 years and then published. And Karl Orff used some of those poems in his work Carmina Burana, which must have been written in the late 30s, 1930s. And Karl Orff is a problematic person because he worked with the Nazis. He was also a great science educator, a great music educator. He specialized in sound patterns, rhythmic patterns, instruments for children. Carmina III, he wrote three things based on some of these Latin lyrics. They're a mixture of Latin and Old High German and some everything in between in dialect. And they celebrate love, gambling, all the things the monks were not supposed to do. So that to me, they've been translated, and there's a book by Helen Waddell called The Wandering Scholars. And it's about the troubadours and the monks. So this is a story of counterculture in medieval time and Renaissance times. And somehow that romantically appealed to this 19-year-old at that time. But I came to them by listening to Carmina Burana. And I remember clearly when I first heard Carmina Burana, I was at age 18. It was done by the students at the High School of Music and Art in New York. And I had a friend who was at that high school and took me along, and I was bowled over, as they say, by the music. It was pretty incredible. But then I, given my scholarly academic nature, I actually learned some of the language in order to understand the initial poems around the beginning of college. Anyway, those poems meant a lot to me. But they were sort of light years away from Wallace Stevens, who's more intellectual and very trimmed down. From Wallace Stevens, likes is there are very precise shifts of meanings of words and expressions and a use of syntax, which is what Archie Emmons also did. So these are, I think, Wallace Stevens poetry. Also, William Carlos Williams, these are mid-20th century poets with varying staying power since that time that had some influence on me. Anyway, I began to write poetry. I sent it out in that time, 76, 77, out to be published. I got rejection slips and couldn't get anything published. Eventually, I struck up more of a social relationship with Archie Ammons and a group of us, including somebody who came up to me after the lecture, remembers that time. We began to meet at a coffee house, the Temple of Zeus, that was on campus. And it was I and Phyllis Janowitz, who was a professor of poetry in the English department. She was an inspiration too, because she became an assistant professor at age 45, just so she was coming late to this. And Archie, and myself and David Burek. David Burek was a campus radical who went on, who was an SDS leader in terrible times, 10 years before this time, in the late 60s. But he became a poet. And the four of us, David and I were the non-professionals and in poetry, and Janowitz and Ammons were the poets. And in part, this was an Ammons admiration society, so Ammons was one of these people who needed a lot of stroking. But in time we began to read, we began each to bring a poem to this and read it. And it took me a while to understand the criticism, and Archie and Phyllis were quite gentle and they were good teachers. And we never revised the poem and brought it back. We just brought another poem, but I learned from this. And eventually, I got a poem published. It was only actually after the Nobel Prize, around 83, about 7 years after I started writing. Mm-hmm. And then things went better. I also, in the mid-80s, spent 3 summers, a month each summer, at the Gerasi Resident Arts Program, an artist colony. And that concentrated time helped me somehow. And then I was off, more or less. So that goes back, the poetry goes to that time. The popular science writing started with this Chemistry Imagined, I'm too scholarly on some things. I had, from Helen Waddell's Wandering Scholars and Carmina Burana, I learned about emblem books of the Renaissance. So these are things where there is an image, mysterious, often very much like alchemical drawings, and a verse and a motto. And they're part of the secular publishing of, the first was written by Andrea Alciato in 1520. They're tied up with the beginnings of printing also. They're tied up with bestiaries, with maps, with other things. But they are some of the first secular literature, tremendously popular. Anyway, I had an image of an emblem book of chemistry. And that's what Chemistry Imagined started, a modern emblem book of chemistry. That was around the beginning 80s. That's when I got that NSF grant to support the artist who collaborated with me. The artist I met at the Gerasi Foundation, all of these things are integrated with each other.
And that was Vivian Torrance?
Vivian Torrance. And then The Same and Not the Same came out of some general lectures. So the first time I was asked to give a general lecture, so there is a lesson here I'll tell you about in a moment, was I gave something called the Silliman Lectures, and it was a chemistry lectures at Yale, and it was around, it was before the Nobel Prize, 1980. And as part of the lectures, you are required to give one lecture for a general audience. And I think that was the first lecture I constructed of the type that you heard here. And it came off well, and then I somehow accepted more invitations of that type, and the same and not the same came out of some lectures I gave at Brookhaven. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think much about it being a book, but I had some luck. I came into contact with Columbia University Press, who prints the text of these lectures, but I came upon an art editor who shared my feelings about having lots of art in the book, and who convinced our bosses at Columbia University Press, this is 1987 around, or no, this is 97 now, convinced her bosses to print a book on paper that could take a color illustration on every page. That was non-trivial in those days. It had to be glossy paper. Today the technology is different. And she also helped, she got into the, her name, I've forgotten now, Teresa something, the art editor for Columbia University Press. She came up with suggestions for illustration. She really got into it. And that was good. That, I think, got me back to thinking about art history and such, though I always had been looking at things. The Same and Not the Same has turned out to be a very successful book because it's used by some general or sort of chemistry for poets or science for poets courses. So as a, it's one of the best-selling books of Columbia University Press. University presses don't have that many best-selling. It sold about 15,000 copies as it was printed, which is a respectable number for a science book. So that was that, and then I began to work on the book about science and Jewish religious tradition, Old Wine, New Flasks. Each of these has a story of its origins, which I could tell you, but somehow I was filling in the ground about writing about science and other things, and I was reflective usually, but these were giving me a chance to write about the relationship of chemistry and philosophy, religion, history. Everything's connected to everything else. For the book with Vivian Torrance, Chemistry Imagined, I hit another stroke of luck, and then as Madeline Jacobs, before she became the CEO of the ACS, worked for the Smithsonian, and she saw the, I submitted it there, and she liked it, and she helped me get it published. So that we had the book, we had an art exhibition, but we also had the book published by a prestigious Smithsonian Institution Press. So that helped a lot. For that book, I did, there was a pairing of collages and essays, and I read the story of the discovery of oxygen. I don't remember now where I first read it, but right after I read it, I became aware that Cornell had a Lavoisier collection, and the curator of that collection, David Corson, showed it to me and showed me Madame Lavoisier's Necessaire, which came along with a collection, a travel chest she had. It's illustrated in the Oxygen play. And I looked at it and it was a magical object. So this is something about, this is something which you have, which is, there's the power of objects, which in conjunction with books or in addition to books have, because they are tangible, in your your case, you have old instruments and things like that. There may be chemical kits. They have a magical power. Madame Lavoisier's necessaire, handled with white gloves on in a Cornell Rare Books collection, is not a book. Actually, on the outside, it pretends to be a book. It says, it folds up, it was made by an English company working in selling things in Paris in the first decade of the 19th century during the Napoleonic Wars. I don't quite understand how it was done. And the etiquette from the manufacturer is in there, because that's how we know who made it. On the outside, the necessaire is made to look like a book. It folds up into a book. And the label of the book is, it's in tooled leather, and or a simulated tool leather, I think, in wood. And it says, Histoire des théâtres. So the article, des is D-E-S, is plural, and it's a mistake in the English, in the French, but it's okay, it was done by the English. I thought that was funny, because if they had any sense, they wouldn't have made a mistake. We know, everyone has noticed it. Anyway, handling that object made me want to write more about that, and eventually that turned into the play. But before the play, I learned the history more in order to write a two-page essay which was one of the 30 collage essay pairs in Chemistry Imagine, and the essay was called The Air of Revolution. It was about oxygen. And I think I saw the play even there. I read the rudiments of it. I don't think I read deeply about Lavoisier. I read a little bit. Not as I didn't know much about Priestley, and Scheele had an interest because he was Swedish, because I'm close to the culture. Anyway, that was planted the seed of the play. So all these connections.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I'm curious to know a bit more about is. You talked about having this poetry group. You're at Cornell. It's a large university in a small town.
Yes.
How did the initial connections come about to these other individuals? Were you just calling professors up and saying, hey, you know, I'm writing some poetry?
So the first thing to say is it was much easier for this to happen at Cornell than it is at Columbia or Harvard. The reason is that we are in a small town, so you see the same people in a social environment, and you overcome the sort of first hesitations. You see them at the farmer's market, you see them at the gym, you see them in the coffee shops. Whereas at Harvard and Columbia, the professors would disappear to the wilds of New Jersey or Lexington or Arlington. And you'd never see them socially, except during the day. So it was easier. I saw Archie, and I remember one time how I first met him socially. I went on a Saturday morning to an art gallery, and which was run by the wife of an English professor, a colleague of Archie's, it was called Ithaca House. They also published poetry books, but it was an art gallery, and she invited me to have a coffee, and Archie was there sitting coffee. So it was a typical Ithaca instance.
Mm.
And I then kept bumping into him. He went to farmer's market, and he and his wife. And then I went to have coffee at the Temple of Zeus, and there he was. I sat down with him. We started talking. And at one point, I worked up the courage to show him a poem before this group convened. So it is much easier in a small town setting when you want to cross over. People knew I was interested because in these other things. The other thing I did was I sat in on some literature courses in to keep up with the languages. And I wasn't afraid to ask the professor if I could sit in to keep up the languages I knew. So I sat in particular in Russian and German. There were no Swedish courses to speak of. And in German, there was Eric Blackhall, a great scholar of German literature. And for instance, I remember two courses in German, and both of them had an impact. One was a course by a nervous assistant professor, which on Austrian writers in the early 20th century. And he talked about not only writers but critics like Krauss. Who was it who wrote? Musil, the Mann ohne Eigenschaften. And Rilke included. So that's a very interesting group of people, critics and writers, who were on. Rilke was in Prague most of the time, but when he started out there, they were very interesting. And Kafka, yes, Kafka was in there too, by that. And that was very interesting. And then Eric Blackhall taught a course on Goethe's poetry, and that was fantastic. And because I knew the professor, he actually had me participate. He had me prepare. He asked, could you talk about Goethe's science? So I read the theory of color and Goethe's particular dislike of Newton, and also I saw how it worked out. So in Russian, there was Alex Sholkovsky, and he taught a course on Pasternak. Pasternak's poetry, and I sat in he was a great teacher. He's left, he's at University of Southern California. He had a sort of scientific orientation. He came from a structuralist school, Roman Jakobson and other people, and these were people who applied to the literature some early sort of quasi-scientific things of looking in on recurring words, how often words recurred and which themes recurred. He introduced me to some older literary criticism. But Alek Sholkovsky was also one of these people who could, like a number of Russians, who could recite Pasternak and Mandelstam and Tsvetaeva, and he had the books memorized. Poetry memorized, and that was somehow people became aware that I was interested, and I really sat in on those courses whenever I was around every, and so I had an entry. It was easier at Cornell. This is one of the good things about Cornell and Ithaca, that it allowed me to make contact with people in the
Were you an anomaly as far as you knew in terms of that connection, or were there other science professors that were involving themselves in the humanities?
I was not the only one, but I was an anomaly.
Okay.
Just not that many. There were other poets who were not members of the English department. There are in any community. There are people working elsewhere. There's a guy working Cornell University Library since his hippie days, who's a really good poet, Fred Moratori. There are people all around who do these things. What is his name who works for CNN News? A writer who is a poet and painter. It'll come, name will come. I was somewhat of an anomaly sitting in on courses.
Mm-hmm.
I also sat in, I had at that time, I was separated from my wife for 15 years, and I had a woman friend in Brazil, and I learned Portuguese also by sitting in a course.
Mm-hmm.
The languages were an entree, so the being a European in that sense of the languages was very helpful.
And what about becoming more known, or people finding out about your interests outside of Cornell University? I mean, you mentioned the Drossi. Yeah, and I assume that was something you had to apply to?
I had to apply for, but I think Carl made it easier.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, he was playing more of a role in the administration of the... made it easy. And after that, I made my own way. That is, I have made collaborations with the artists, like the one with Vivian Torres. You know, and that had an impact on the next year that I applied. They liked those collaborations.
Mm-hmm.
So, and to me it was exciting, it was a different group of people.
What was the reaction of your chemist colleagues?
So, the reaction overall is, it's a mixed one. So, the first reaction is, actually, chemists, so I had some colleagues who were musicians, there always are. So that's interesting how at least performance of music, in part because a typical middle class German Jewish kid would be taking violin lessons. There would be no way that kid could escape violin or piano lessons, in fact, in mid 20th century. It was part of being the bourgeoisie. That is, I'm saying it badly, but there's a positive side to it. I escaped music lessons because of the war. Some of my colleagues are very good musicians. There was certainly an opening to that. You ask the next question, how many of them are composers? And you get a very different answer. You don't have that many. But music is special in that way. When chemists write a memoir, you are likely to find poems as epigraphs in these things. They know at some level, they may not be that educated in poetry, but they know its power and its value. And that it's interesting. Some of them harbor writing this little doggerel verse all the time in is another aspect of his culture too, that you were expected to do that. But he did that, he loved it, but he didn't write serious poetry. But then you see Davy, a different world, a different time, writing. Davy could have been a real poet if he had not been a scientist. The poetry does not travel well, Davy's poetry, but it's, I think, in its time, he was taken seriously. The colleagues value the poetry. A scientist in general sometimes have a slightly negative valuation of the humanities across the board of the humanities. Some of it takes on a illiterate caricature of, and has to do with something I mentioned in my talk of resolution and solution. It's the problem, the humanists often keep talking about the same problems that they've been talking about for 2,500 years. Free will and determinism. If you can't decide which it is, and if freshman students can have an opinion about that, maybe it's not worth studying. of course it is. So there is a little bit of that. Also, there are unforgiving scientists in the quest for support. God forbid the university should give a free computer to the humanities professors, but not to the chemistry professors. They just forget that the scientists have $400 million in research funds coming in, but the humanists have $500,000. I think there is some, of course, the social construction of science movement did not help in general, because it was viewed as some weird incursion from the humanities with their strange ideas about what constitutes reality and such. There was, and so that there is some, I think overall they're glad somebody is doing it in Bhavmaya writing the poetry. They value it in some way. The next set of reactions are, you have the luxury of doing this. I'm an assistant professor. How is this going? I can't do this. And they're right. We have no system of valuing the external activities of this type for a science professor. That is not only true for me. Emily Grossholz at Penn State, who's a professor of philosophy with major interests in Leibniz and in philosophy of mathematics, is also and she and I have written one article together. She's also an established poet. She's an associate editor of Hudson Review. One time, she put on her annual report to the chairman of her department in philosophy her poems that she published that year. The chairman said, remove those poems. So it's professionalism rampant, and the assistant professor is not going to be valued. They know how they're going to be evaluated in their research. That statement that I don't have a time for it, taken as a reality of the situation of the priorities we as a society place on the junior faculty members, is a realistic evaluation. When it shades over to, I could do it if I only had the time. Now that, there is something else. They don't realize, because they haven't tried it, how difficult it is to write poetry or these other things. And that it takes, that it's true that the article, the unit, the poem is small, but I go through more drafts on that than I go on through in the scientific paper. And that's true also for the essays that I write for American Scientist, which I'm not going to write any more of those. But I also go through more drafts than I go through the scientific papers. Now maybe it's because I've gotten better at the scientific papers, 600 of them down the line, but that is true, but it's not. Everyone is still a problem, but it's not as much of a problem. Now the problem is that the first 10 drafts of the scientific papers are changing Chinese English into real English. But it's, so there, the range of reactions. There is from valuation to a realistic evaluation that this, and they're right that I have that luxury to a certain extent. But there is what hurts most. The only really negative things in a reaction are a occasionally emergent negative evaluation of the humanities and a feeling that this is easy, which is not true. You know, even the best people feel that way, though. A number of people who come from especially European background, have perhaps more of a valuation of culture than culture with a capital K. than most Americans. But if you look, for instance, about in Feynman's books, a kind of aspirational Bible to young scientists, the books about Feynman, because he doesn't write, but where his comments are recorded, you find he did take off a year to do music in Brazil, but at one point he reports his attempts to find value in poetry, I think, and he doesn't find any value in it. And he doesn't get it. He doesn't.
No, given some of what we've been talking about, you know, I now have a better sense of your how you met other professors in the humanities,
yeah,
and things like that. Were similar things happening? So I guess this is a two-part question. Were similar things happening with meeting professors in other departments, science departments, like in physics, in biology,
mm-hmm,
and things along those lines? And I'm also curious to know what is going on outside of your science. I don't know if I really want to use the word outside, but how is all this other stuff, what role is it playing with the science that you're conducting in the post-Nobel period?
Right. So I've somehow, my outreach in science has been more toward physics and none toward biology, of the two directions. And I can't quite understand the biology, though I've tried to rationalize it. So one thing I couldn't understand, we talked about this before, was why when chemistry wasn't inspiring in college, why I didn't get interested in biology. Because this was the 2 years after Watson Crick that I was at Columbia. And the answer is very simple. No one was teaching about Watson and Crick in the biology department at Columbia. They were a bunch of old-fashioned guys. So I would have had to know much more to realize that there was a revolution forming. But later, I think part of my... I had for a couple of years an NIH grant. I wrote an article with Harold Shiragan or a couple of things about peptide conformations that we did. Didn't find it inspiring, but mainly I was working with a methodology, the extended Hückel method for calculating electronic structure, which didn't get energies right very much. It only dealt very, it was not good in detail on energetics. And I could have parametrized it to death to get energetics right. Energetics of what? Of, for instance, the energy needed to take an amino acid and twist around the conformational energies of amino acids, or have energies of hydrolysis of phosphate esters, something important in biology. I realized in reading a little biology that the control in biology due to the workings of evolution was by accumulating small differences of energy. So it wasn't that some gigantic, that all of a sudden a new active site was created by having totally different functional groups on the amino acids surrounding the things. Rather, there were some little motions, adjustments, which made many amino acids made a fit better of this. And I couldn't get small energies right with my method. And it's sort of obvious that evolution works this way, by aggregating small pieces to create a big effect. It is true that there are some places where there is a large input or change in energy. For instance, in photosynthesis, there comes in a photon or two photons with a total energy of several hundred kilocalories per mole, but it very quickly gets degraded into many ATP molecules that then go on to do something, the commerce of the cell as far as the energy is concerned. With the methods that I could do, I also done something about some metalloenzymes, but somehow every attempt I've made to get interested in biology, except culturally, that it's very exciting to know these things, how they work, has not been successful. Somehow my set of mind and the way biology works biochemistry works did not come together. On the physics side, it's been different. And I'm conflicted because part of what I do is I'm interested in fighting the reductionism that is rampant in physics, vis-a-vis chemistry especially. And I'm interested in I believe that chemists understand things better than physicists as far as bonding. But that's not what the physicists think, and it's not what many chemists think. I could go into why I think we understand better, but that's another story. I have reached out to physics, and I've wanted to do things, in part because I've seen that in dealing with that community, that there is value to the chemical ways of thinking. So I'm interested in that. So how did I reach out? There are two things you asked about, have I had these interactions with people in other communities? I've had interactions with physics, applied physics, material science, not with biology. The interactions with these other communities in part were made feasible by structures that existed at Cornell, in particular a Center for Materials Research, which is the oldest one of these umbrella grants, originally from DARPA, now from NSF. And we had the oldest one, and I'm not at all responsible for it, but I was a member of this, and they supported some of my work for a while. They don't support any now. But it made me go to some lectures. Okay, that's one. Second, there is a tradition of doing this at Cornell, and that is interesting and worth a PhD thesis. And it has to do with the fact that there were three people who came over from Europe in the 30s, or 40s, they were Peter Debye, Hans Bethe, who came in 33, and the third one is less well known, Henri Sack, S-A-C-K. Sack became a department chair in engineering, Bethe became a valued member in physics, Debye, who could have been in a chemistry or physics department, was in the chemistry department, was chair of the chemistry department from 1940 to 46, or maybe even longer. They knew each other from Europe, and they each moved across physics and something else, and they somehow created a culture. Hans Bethe is remarkable, because we think of him in terms of the mechanism of solar energy generation and of the work on the hydrogen and atomic bombs, and where he had it, the explosion effort. But he also consistently pushed for the valuation of solid state physics in a time after the Manhattan Project, when nuclear physics was dominant instructor at Cornell called the Laboratory of Atomic and Solid State Physics that created a strength in the physics department that was very important. Hans Bethe was very important in this way. I didn't know him very well. There was too much of an age difference somehow. I knew him a little socially, but I didn't know him well. The structure generated at Cornell, or in general interaction between these departments, the particular structure of the Center for Materials Research, and then just things happening. So for instance, the last 10 years I've been working on materials under high pressure. And this is a collaboration with Neil Ashcroft, who is a leading solid state physicist. There is a book, there are two textbooks of solid state physics that have dominated the market for 40 years. And these are Kittel and Ashcroft and Merman. And Ashcroft and Merman are Cornell fixtures. Neil Ashcroft, originally from New Zealand and England, and then came to the United States the same, came to Cornell the same year I did, 65. And we didn't publish a paper until 2006 together. That's 41 years. We knew each other, we respected each other, of course. But it took a Polish postdoc of mine, a very, not aggressive, but outgoing postdoc, Wojciech Grochala, G-R-O-C-H-A-L-A, who is now back in Poland, who, while he was working on something with me, went over and talked to Neil. And I didn't tell him to go and talk to Neil. He went over and talked to Neil. He was that way. He went and talked to everybody. And Neil got interested in this problem, and Wojciech said, let's do this, study these things under high pressure, and I said, okay. So I had a part in giving the postdoc some freedom. And eventually we looked at the structure of silane, SiH4, under pressure. Wojciech did, and a graduate student of mine did the work. Neil and I were on a paper, we contributed equally, and we've been all, we have now a joint research grant. And we're both 7 years retired, but we're both active in research, and we're working. We have published 20 papers together in the last years. So that came from I wish all postdocs were like that. Can't.
You described once how important experimental science is for your theoretical work.
Yes.
Could you go under the perspective of what we have been just talking about, go into a bit more detail what the important points for you are and who the important people were in over your career that imprinted something on you and your work?
So, I am a theoretician, I have always been, though the first two papers I published were experimental ones. One was when I was 18 on the thermochemistry of some compounds in Portland cement. Both came from summer jobs. And the next paper was on a low-level counting system for carbon-11. Isotope, which is a 20-minute half-life unstable carbon isotope, made from a reaction of carbon-12 with a proton, and a neutron is essentially subtracted from carbon-12. Anyway, experiment was imprinted on me by the fortune of work with two important people, Lipscomb and Woodward, initially. I'll tell you a little what the result of that is, but Lipscomb was many things, a crystallographer, a boron hydride chemist, a theoretician also, and eventually a biochemist in a crystallography sense. I worked with Lipscomb on boron hydrides, which were a very active field of research at that time, around 1960. My PhD was 1962. It is on theory of polyhedral molecules with Lipscomb and with Martin Guterman. Martin Guterman, that's Guterman, then went on, was the person I first worked with. I switched to Lipscomb. Guterman was a theoretician purely, but very interested in porphyrins all his life. And I even tried to make a porphyrin in my first year in graduate school and had an explosion, making a mess of a brand new laboratory in a new building. There was no group to work with. I improvised myself, and it was a bomb reaction. I didn't seal the glass bomb very well, and it exploded. Thank God, hurting nobody. But it was not a pleasant business. It was the last experiment I did. First year graduate school. Guterman was very interested in the spectra of porphyrins. They're very intense. I mentioned sthalocyanines, which are related to porphyrins. Very intense absorption, strong colors of these. And the heme group in iron, the red of blood, is an absorption in the porphyrin system. I was sensitized to experiment work there. Lipscomb consistently made connection to experiment in the boron hydrides. Coming to visit us, for instance, was Fred Hawthorne, bringing us news of the first synthesis of icosahedral B12, H12, 2-. Potassium salt of that. We immediately did a calculation on that. He told us, Hawthorne, of the carboranes, compounds in which two BH groups were replaced by CH groups in that ion to make a neutral C10B2H12. We did calculations of various isomers of that. There were comparisons with stabilities. Experiment was there, emphasized by Lipscomb at every point. And he did crystal structures too in another part of the laboratory, and I could watch that. Then with Woodward, the story is a long one, and Jeff Seaman will tell the story of our interaction, and Jeff has also looked carefully at my notebooks, and you can see in those notebooks, it was a revelation to me to look. The miracle is I kept notebooks in those times, which I haven't. They're not dated. They're not like an industrial company where you date every day and you witness it. They're badly dated. Every few weeks there is a mention of a seminar and there is a date. But otherwise, Jeff is just, as a historian, is just totally upset with me for not keeping these better records that he can. But at least I kept the things in the notebooks, what are the calculations I did. And they are an interest, they are a great record, but they're also a record of my development in organic chemistry. That's the other story that he's seen, and it's wonderful for me to see it. I was just drinking in organic chemistry. I was also sitting in on an important course for me by Doug Applequist. I kept the lecture notes from that course we have. And that introduced me to physical organic chemistry. Anyway, with Woodward, I was dealing with someone with an encyclopedic knowledge of the literature that comes through in everything that people write about Woodward. And my image of Woodward is in the library looking through Chemische Berichte and in his blue suit. But he knew so much. And of course, one of the reasons the orbital symmetry story made an impact, it's a very complicated story in there, but it dealt with new experiments that were related to old experiments. The new experiments were from physical organic chemists in the US and in Germany, especially with Vogel and Krieger, and certain specificities they noticed in some reactions. the old chemistry was having the very complicated natural product chemistry of vitamin D and its transformations with heat and light. And that, the Fogel and Krieger was accessible to me. The vitamin D stereochemistry dealing with a complicated natural products looked too complicated to me, a theoretician. And it's Woodward who had to pull out the essence, because he used it in the synthesis of his own, the stereochemistry. He had to pull out the stereochemical essence and simplify it to the point where I could do calculations on it. But of course, what made the orbital symmetry story successful, aside from the nexus between molecular orbital theory and organic chemistry that it formed, was that it accounted for things, rationalized the reactions, but it also made predictions, and the predictions were of stereochemistry of certain reactions. The predictions were readily verifiable on a time scale of 1 year, and there was a community out there of physical organic chemists formed by other interests. So this is now intersects with non-classical carbonium ions, with the utility of the Hückel model in explaining certain molecules. There was a community there waiting to do the experiments, which didn't take 50 years to do. It could be done in a year. So there was a tremendous flurry of activity testing our predictions in various ways. So there's very important that there's a community of people ready to do the experiments. There is such a community out there on superconductivity. Anytime somebody comes up with a new material, immediately there are 100 papers. There are a lot of underemployed solid-state physicists who are waiting for the next molecule, for the next system to study. This was sort of the situation where I was very lucky, but what I'm, in the context of what you asked, the interaction with that community of publishing, you can look at the papers and you can see relatively few citations to pre-existing theory or such, but relatively many citations to experiments with that stereochemistry. And in about a year or two, there was a flood of such experiments and a lot to interact with. So there was an experimental community there. In terms of instruments and techniques, there is another story I mentioned because you worked on those. And this is now a story about computers and quantum chemistry calculations. So I was in on the beginning of that. My whole career is tied up with computers, but then I think the peculiar success of what we did with time and what I evolved as a technique was that I somehow grew more interested in chemistry, and I learned how to construct explanations, and I did that from the work with Woodward mainly, more than Lipscomb. With Lipscomb, I'm still in a calculator mode. So what was it that, I think what I learned from Woodward was the power of a simple explanation in terms of, and I put it in terms of orbitals. And I rediscovered the language of quantum mechanics, which I had learned, which other people knew, but I applied it to, there are many keys to success to it, but I applied it to problems. I applied it to construction of explanation. So the story of me and computers is a long story where what I do is completely tied to computers all my life. But much of what I do is fighting the computer and stepwise an interaction with a computer, which is not just to generate numbers, but a stepwise cutting of the paring down of the computer performed operations, which I trust and don't trust in measure, paring them down to get little orbital explanations.
How do you do that?
Well, it's, first of all, it didn't come overnight, it evolved. But part of it came from that Woodward came to me with a simple orbital explanation in terms of the symmetry properties of highest occupied molecular orbital. I began as a calculator, and not disbelieving his explanation, I said, let me do a calculation on butadiene closing to cyclobutene. And I did a calculation with the ends of the butadiene molecule rotating this way and the other way. And the first time they didn't come out supporting the calculation, the simple argument. I then realized that what I had done was I had not progressed along the reaction coordinate in a right way. I kept the butadiene molecule carbons frozen. So then what had to happen from butadiene was that the CCC bond angle had to go down as it formed a ring from the chain. When I put that in, I recovered the orbital argument that he had, and I slowly realized that that simple orbital argument had some power, which more than the calculations. I also realized, then we get a technique of drawing correlation diagrams, which I learned a lot from Christopher Long at Higgins, but I had drawn them before, but I hadn't realized their power. Long at Higgins, who wrote an important paper after our first paper, explaining the electrocyclic reactions with a correlation diagram. That was up my alley. I knew symmetry and correlation diagrams, and I applied that quickly. I saw the explanatory power. Somehow I felt that when I talked to people, so here is where I wasn't yet teaching for a first year chemistry, but I was applying the same strategies that I did in teaching of empathy and trying to make caring that the audience understands. I could see that that simple orbital explanation had more power over people's minds than the numbers. The numbers were not comprehensible. This simple explanation was. And somehow I began to use more and more of these. And the language of perturbation theory, a certain way to deal with small changes in geometry or in some other aspect from quantum mechanics, I worked out a mixed sort of verbal visual language of explaining orbital interactions. The verbal was the word, there were these level, the visual language was, first of all, the orbital level, so those little drawings of the 2p orbitals and such. But there was also orbital interaction diagrams, so there were energy levels, and the energy levels repelled each other. That is the result that comes from perturbation theory, that when two levels interact, one goes down, the other one goes up. It was well known, but I made a language of those ideas of interaction diagrams and orbital pictures. And you know, I think what I constructed and it wasn't just me but others, but we constructed a visual language mixed symbolic and iconic, and to use semiotic terms here. Iconic, these little drawings were represented where a lone pair was. There really was a maximum electron density. The symbolic was maybe the wave functions that were interacting, and the energy levels going up and down was a mixture of symbolic and iconic. I don't want to stress the idea. I'm convinced, and from the work with Emily, that chemists mix the two languages, and their productivity comes. The productivity of chemists in general in dealing with explanations comes from their violating every philosophical category for forming explanations. That is, chemists will do anything to get an explanation, and they're not necessarily rational. All the categories you devise, inductive, deductive, symbolic, iconic, natural, unnatural, they're going to violate all of those. They're going to make a DNA molecule take the shape of a cube. They're going to mix up the things. I think the same unexplanatory power. That's why I'm attracted in the philosophy of science. A lot of what classical philosophers do of science is they just try to push everything into boxes of one type of rational being. And they basically, they think people are irrational, but scientists are not necessarily irrational. They're anxious to understand. And my current metaphor is they're scrabblers. They'll do anything to get up to the top of the hill.
Is it that what you just described for chemists that makes them better understand that maybe physicists do?
In part, one of the reasons. But the other part is that they know less mathematics, therefore they deal more in verbal construction. Though some of them learn a lot of mathematics, but if you take an average experimental physicist, they know more mathematics because of their education, mathematical physics and mathematics, than an average experimental chemist. And the average experimental chemist will learn just enough to understand and not much more. That's, for instance, true for NMR, to evaluate that you get a certain number of splittings of the line, but let's not worry too much about the physics of the actual coupling constant that makes for the splitting of the lines. And they'll apply this. I think given, faced with the complexity of chemical bonding, I think there are two reasons why chemists understand things better. One is because they know mathematics less, so they work harder to get qualitative explanations based on these kinds of pictures that I have drawn in part. The other part is the same thing that I mentioned yesterday about the poetics of particularity in chemistry. That is, given that there are 70 million molecules, they present many situations of bonding. And in particular, much of that variability is just multiplicity of simple bonding. But there are enough other things so that theoretical chemists, or chemists in general, are forced to deal with a multifarious reality based on 70 million molecules. Whereas physicists, solid state physicists, condensed matter physicists, are close to chemistry. The superconductors are cuprates, and then tomorrow they're iron, selenide, and another molecule. They're closer to us, but by and large, physicists construct a reality that they deal with, which is not as rich in examples as the chemical reality that we are confronted with. So I think that I should write about that sometime. What were we talking about?
We've been speaking a bit about the science and how you were pursuing it, the interactions you had somewhat with physicists. One thing that you had made reference to, but I wanted to...
So I'm interested in interactions in general. I mean, I entitled the Nobel lecture Building Bridges Between Inorganic and Organic Chemistry. There's something, the building bridges metaphor. My father was a civil engineer, so maybe there is something there. Mm-hmm. And he did build, if not bridges, then culverts and small bridges maybe, and roads and things like that in the brief life that he had. When he died, he was 32, so there wasn't that much in his life. The bridges as the inorganic organic metaphor was very important to me, and now I have a bridge to solid state physics. And then, in some sense, my activities in the humanities can be viewed as another kind of bridging behavior. I don't do this on purpose. Or yes, I do part of it on purpose. I don't do it on purpose. As you've heard me describe how the interest arose in the poetry and how I sat in on classes or went and talked to Archie and met him, there was no plan in this. I was just following my nose. Hmm. But I was interested enough to have that interaction. I find it interesting to build connections. There is a tension within me that building connections or seeing similarities, there's a little bit of it in that lecture. Notice I said, I don't have time to talk to you, I said, but there are many commonalities between art and science. But I put up two differences. That's because I wanted to get into something. I'm aware that too much focus on similarities is a little bit reductive and simplistic and plays into thinking that the world is rather simple, that it's all one thing. Whereas I think what attracts me, and this is, I'm describing the tension, is the particularity that the world is many things. That's a tension within me, but building these bridges feels important to me, and I'm willing to risk some things. Writing poetry is risking a number of things. And yet, there are some things I don't want to risk, but I'm willing to risk some things professionally to do these things which build bridges.
You earlier today you made mention of the fact that with your NSF funding you were criticized for outreach component, and it had to do with referencing the science cabarets.
Yes.
So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how those science cabarets came about and what it is that you wanted to achieve with such things, especially since we're talking about bridges and...
Yes. So there is an origin story to the Cornelia Street Cafe, what we now call Entertaining Science Cabaret. Cabaret is not the right word exactly. Coffee shop or... Well, the story... So it's everything has an origin story, and I think the only lesson to be learned is here is a person who follows things up into which he has fallen and by accident. There is no... The origin story is I'm on a sabbatical at Columbia for a half year in 2002, and Casey Cole, a science writer who writes mainly about physics, who by that time is based in California. She has written a book, A Universe in a Teacup, about how physicists searching for nothing found a theory of everything. Searching for nothing is the ether, and theory of everything was in part quantum mechanics. So she writes a book about this, and she's talking about the feeling of nothingness. And in the book, she cites some things by me, maybe a poem, and she cites Oliver Sacks, his book, A Leg to Stand On, about how he loses the sensation of a leg in an accident, or the nerve gets damaged, and he talks about that feeling. She has that in a book. She wants to publicize the book. She writes, she has a friend who knew the owner of this Cornelia Street Cafe, Robin Hirsch, who's an entertainer, and a restaurant owner, and Casey, she goes by her initials, Casey. It's like Casey Nicolau, actually, when I think about it. Anyway, she writes to Robin, says she wants to do a reading to publicize her book. Robin is running something every day of the year at the entertainment space downtown. Robin Hirsch is his name. There is a 60s jazz club setting with 60 seats in a narrow room and little 8x8 stage in front. Upstairs is a restaurant. He runs something at 6 and at 9 o'clock every evening, performance, often spoken word. All kinds of people play there, talk there. And she writes to him, and she wants to do a talk about her book. He says, "You're not famous enough." She doesn't give up. She comes to me, and she says, "Would you do it with me?" And goes back to, I say yes. She goes back to Robin. He says, "Neither of you are famous enough." She doesn't give up. She and I talk. We decide to invite Oliver. Oliver is a friend of mine at this point. Oliver is dying right now, and that is a sadness. We ask Oliver because he's quoted in a book, so we ask him. And I'm going to read some poetry, Oliver's going to read from the book, and she's going to read from her book. All of a sudden, we're famous enough. So he puts us on the schedule. Oliver has a friend, Ron Weschler, who is now a director of a Center of Humanities at NYU, but is a writer. He was a writer for The New Yorker at that time. He's editing by Chance the News and Views, the front section of The New Yorker. He does a paragraph on our show, and he interviews someone at the cafe, a poet who's very good, and what are these people going to talk about? And the poet, Angelo Verga, answers something like, "Well, they claim they're going to talk about nothing." And isn't that a great subject? So anyway, 300 people show up on the street for this show. There's room for 60. The police are called to disperse the unhappy people who couldn't get in. The cafe owner is overjoyed. And we have a good evening, and I'm the entertainment in a way. I'm the poetry, the others are more serious. Interesting that I would say that poetry is not serious. But anyway, I'm the entertainment here. My part in this, aside from the story I've told you, is I realize we have something. It came together entirely by chance, and it was Casey who was the driving force. But I write to Robin and ask him, "Hey, can we do this on a regular basis, once a month?" And he says, "Yes, on a basis of that big crowd." And so I schedule a first program. I remember the first program. So already from, I had these three things, and what we didn't have was music, but we had poetry. But the next one I schedule, I asked Lynn Margulis, whom I knew, and I knew she came to New York because she had a son living in New York. One of her children was Sagan. Lynn was Carl Sagan's first wife, aside from being an iconoclastic biologist. So I invited her. Her son talked, and they had a grandson who played rock music, bad music. Anyway, they were the second show. We got a good crowd. We filled the place. So at that point, we had it. So then I've had this for 12, 13 years. I now have somebody running it with me. Tried to give it up for a while, but the people I gave it to couldn't run it. But Dave Soldier, who's a molecular biologist, neurophysiologist at Columbia, and a musician himself, run it. And we have it once a month. Mm-hmm. And we range far afield. For instance, the next program will be on Easter Sunday, 2 weeks from tomorrow. And so what shall I... We run it by doing it the first Sunday of every month. We do it regularly. We run into Super Bowl Sunday. We occasionally run into Easter Sunday. Sometimes we always run into Labor Day. And we run sometimes into January 1st, which is we give up. We don't have it. But we are not fazed by Super Bowl Sunday. We fill the place. We charge $20. You get a free drink for that. And we fill the place pretty much every time. So I'll give you an idea of how far afield we go. For a Sunday, Easter Sunday, I thought, Easter, eggs. We got to do something on eggs. In Sweden, there's a tradition. Children put a little egg under their bed, and there are some sweets put into it. But then there are Ukrainian eggs that are colored, and there is eggs baked into Greek pies, something. Anyway, eggs. So I went to the cafe chef, Dan Latham, who was a laid-back southerner. I said, we got to do something on eggs. He had done one program before where he had participated on snails, where I had Mandy Halford, who's a associate professor, I think, by now, who studies poisonous snails, the venoms from beautiful Pacific snails, which are poisonous. And I combined that with a cafe chef cooking edible snails. So this time, the cafe chef is going to make some things from eggs. So then I had to think, what science can I pair with that? If I were at Cornell, we have a poultry department or sub-department somewhere in the EXCO. And I would turn there. Long time ago, I knew a guy named Romanoff, who was a world expert on eggs. But I'm in New York. There aren't too many poultry departments in New York City. So what am I going to do? I don't know. Turns out there are people raising chickens in Brooklyn and Queens. There's a whole association of them. I was almost ready to. But I remembered I had seen a book by a science writer called, don't remember his name. He's written over 1,000 articles. He's written something he's been writing steadily for Science and for Discover. Can't remember his name. He wrote a book called The Chicken That Crossed the World. And it's a cultural history of the chicken. It's about biology, too. about making of vaccines, for instance, but also about how the use of poultry has gone up in the United States as a meat, as a source of protein relative to beef and other things. He's in North Carolina, I didn't know where he was, but he, by chance, will be in New York. Usually, we don't have a budget, but I saw that it was difficult for him, so I'm paying for him for a hotel room in New York for one day, but usually we don't pay anything, get paid in some free dinners. Mm-hmm. So that's the program. It's called Extravaganza, and it's the science part is not a scientist this time, it's a science writer, but they're often better at doing the science than the scientist. And the entertainment part is the chef making some egg dishes.
What sort of responses have you gotten to?
Very positive responses from people. But I've been asked to move this uptown or to move it to some other place. I haven't done that. A competing show or an offshoot of ours called Secret Science Sunday has moved from a Brooklyn location to Symphony Space on 90th Street. I envy what they do. They somehow fell into a Dorian Devens, who organizes that, fell into a relationship with a cafe in Brooklyn that bought a rock club. They moved. They've given up on the entertainment, except they play. Imagine a hall, a vast hall, 300 to 400 young people, raucous rock, or worse, not rock, but techno and other stuff, played before and after, and then a scientist talking for 30 minutes. And what I envy them is they have a young audience, where we don't. We have a generally aging audience. But it's okay. We have that scrambling to put together the chef with the eggs to find an egg scientist. Sometimes it's the other way. That I have the scientist and then I struggle. But between Dave and me, we find somebody in the New York area, because we have no budget, ranging afield to Rutgers, Princeton, Cornell. We find somebody to the American Museum of Natural History, Rockefeller, our natural places where we get the scientists from. The scientist talks for half an hour. After 5 years' work, I could convince the cafe to put in a projector. This is a jazz club. This is not a. They're not used to this. Mm-hmm. Until then, I would bring down a projector from Cornell and we'd put it on a. The scientists in general, one or two exceptions in 12 years, are unwilling to talk without showing slides.
There are a couple of other things I want to talk about, which, I mean, in some ways, this is going to backtrack us a little bit.
Sure.
But I wanted to have some more information about, for example, I'd like to start with the World of Chemistry on mm-hmm. PBS and hear a little bit about how that came about and why it came about.
Yes. So that took 2 years of my life, from about 87 to 89. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad I did it. Didn't get paid for it anymore, and got leave from Cornell to do for about a year to do it. Came about as a project in the mind of one person who's no longer alive. Isidore Adler, Izzy Adler, was a professor of nuclear chemistry at the University of Maryland, and was interested in education, and he pitched the idea somehow, eventually was encouraged, and he wrote a proposal. And he had a committee of four other people. One of them was an enterprising Israeli science educator, Nava Ben-Zvi, and she has just retired in Israel. She and Izzy were the directors of the project. On that, the other people were a high school teacher from the Washington area, a couple of other people. I was brought on this as a presenter because, and I think the Nobel Prize may have played some role in that. In the end, I wound up, I'll tell you something about the project, the magnitude, I wound up not just the presenter, but I worked with the other five people in writing the scripts for the shows. The project was of some magnitude, 26 half-hour shows, directed for PBS, but also there was a misplaced ideal of a remote learner situation. This could be used. It misplaced because it was unrealistic in America. But the idea was it would be shown on public access TV or PBS, and then people could register at a community college, maybe take a lab there, and then get credit for that as a course. It was ahead of its time, I think. Today, it would be one of these courses. But the funding was a main grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which was interested to get into this business, and had in the previous year sponsored a physics course out of Caltech, which proved too difficult because of the Caltech origin. A leading physicist educator, David, I don't have the last name at the moment, was the main person on that. There was Richard Thomas, a leading science producer who had played an important part in the previous series that PBS was very successful, called The Brain, around the 80s. He was the executive producer. The line delineation between the academic team of six people and the production company. There was a production company in Washington area. Some funding was raised from additional sources, American Chemical Society, Eastman, Kodak, Dow. Not too much. The main funding was, the total budget approached $3 million, and that was to make 26 episodes. The average budget sort of per episode, half-hour episodes, was around $50,000 to $75,000. It would be more today in today's money, but to put that in focus, it was one half to one third the price of a NOVA program, which was a contemporary already. So there was less money than in a NOVA program, but still, this was professional TV, very expensive. There were various components in these programs. It was like a chemistry course. It still is. Yesterday at the reception, there were two people who mentioned that program. High school teachers who came here, and they were grateful for the program. To this day, I get telephone calls or one email message a week from high school students who are taking, who are seeing those. This is now 25 years after, or longer, yeah, 25 years. Occasionally it's shown on some PBS stations as a filler in the middle of the night. It's a funny, one time I get a call from a student, a former student of mine, and he said, Dr. Hoffman, I have to tell you this, I went home to my parents and I fell asleep on a couch with the TV on, and I woke up in the middle of the night and there you were on the TV. I said, I thought I was having a nightmare. It was difficult to make it for a variety of reasons. I was on for 3 minutes in each show, the beginning, the end, and sometimes a bridge in the very middle. There was another live component. It was a lecture demonstrator, a guy named Don Showalter, who's University of Wisconsin at Stevens Point. We were the only two live people. Then there were interviews. A mark of the most expensive element was the rather primitive animation, the kind of animation which a high school student could make on a home computer today in 5 minutes cost much more than anything else. Many things about the programs, but one of its strengths came out of an improvisation with a weakness. We didn't have enough of a budget to shoot some scenes which we would have wanted to shoot live. I'll give you an example. There's a program on electrochemistry. A prime thing is the whole process for making aluminum with electrochemistry through a molten alumina salt. These are gigantic machines that do this. We would have liked to go to a Alcoa plant and to film the thing. We didn't have money, so we used Alcoa footage. This is called a stock footage. So an advertisement for Alcoa, which shows, of course, their grandiose plant, everything in a nice light for doing this. And the most important person I learned about the importance of Very Straight was the editor who would take that footage cut out from it. NASA was another prime source, government sources of footage. Anyway, then what we had was we were forced to use stock footage, but the montage on the whole process has a verisimilitude. It's real, it's from an industrial source, and nobody would show the whole process actually working in a classroom. No teacher could show it, but we had the footage there. It wasn't the best. So we had many real-life industrial situations, a lot of hidden advertising. A knowledgeable person who could have looked at some of that stock footage could have said, this comes from this company, this comes from that company. We didn't know that. We thought nobody would know. The program was successful. We went back a few years later to make a few more programs. We couldn't get the funding. We ran into some beginning 90s and some economic downturn. There is nothing better out there. So there are teachers still using this. It's dated a little, but teachers are still finding it useful. The only thing that has, there is no course out there. There are individual demonstrations which are better. We also made a mistake. We didn't write a textbook to go with it. We didn't plan it. Well, but it's okay. I'm happy what we did. The only thing that's new, that's better than what we have, idiosyncratic but better, are the periodic table videos by Martin Polyakov and made with a BBC producer, Brian, forgotten his name. They are offbeat little videos, 5 minutes or so, about different elements, different scientific discoveries. I'm glad we made it.
In 1996, you became the Rhodes Professor of Humane Letters.
Yes, Frank H. T. Rhodes was 18 years old, 18 years a president of Cornell. Mm-hmm. Would not have been anticipated to be a great president. In fact, he was. and became a figure on the national scene. And this professorship was, I think, first, I'm very glad to have that association with him. He's still alive. He's a very important person for Cornell, no longer the president for some time. He became a friend, but this association, this professorship meant no funds, no resources, but it was a recognition by the university of my interest in the humanities. Mm-hmm. What exactly humane letters means is totally unclear, and people have trouble translating it. It just means that the guy is interested in everything, which is true.
Did you know that you were going to receive it? I mean, is this like the Nobel?
No, it was not. Usually named professorships are a medium impact way for a donor to leave an impact on the university. Mm-hmm. I mean, it takes $2 to $5 million to endow a named professorship, something like that. So it's not a building, but it's... To name it, we know who it was endowed by. To name it after Frank Rhodes and not themselves is a tribute to Frank Rhodes. Mm-hmm. I had another named professorship before that, named after a guy, after his no good son, but a guy who was rich and a Cornell chemical engineer. That was Mr. Newman. But it means no resources, nothing. It was just, it was an honorific.
Okay. I mean, I was in part curious about it, in part knowing that old wine, new flasks came out in 1997.
Yeah, there's no relation.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit more about why it is that you undertook that book? I mean,
yes,
in our interviews, you haven't spoken too much. I mean, you've spoken about, growing up, being Jewish.
Yes.
But, you know, Judaism hasn't necessarily framed a lot of our discussion. So I'm wondering where...
And it doesn't frame too much of my life, though I feel very Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And having lived through the Holocaust, it leaves a trace. And I've written this play more recently about my mother and me and our survival. The Jewishness Jewish identity is constructed in, using academic terms, Jewish identity is constructed in many different ways. And it was, as I told you at the beginning, the name Roald was coming out of some construction of Jewish identity in Poland in 1937, that you would give your child a secular name and not a Jewish name. Hmm. Became easier in America. It was easier to be a Jew in America, of course. But I wasn't very Jewish, and I married somebody who wasn't Jewish, and that got me in trouble with the family, but they got over it when they had grandchildren. So, but it made life uncomfortable for my wife for some time. I named my son Hillel, a very Jewish name. But our daughter's called Ingrid, so we're constructing our, and let's say it was after family, in my mind it's after Ingrid Bergman. We're constructing our identity in some complex way. Just before I came here on Wednesday morning, I spoke to a high school class at a charter school in Ithaca about being a child during the Holocaust, the 10th grade class. And I do a lot of these talks. More recently, I've written some poems about that time, trying to unearth some memories. I've not written a biography, but I've written little pieces pieces here and there. And I wrote this book. The book came about by accident, like everything else. What happened was that I was getting an honorary degree from Be'er Sheva University, where Uta Deichmann is now, Ben Gurion University of the Negev. And they wanted me to give a general talk. So I decided to, I had a talk at that time called Natural Unnatural, about the dichotomy between natural things and synthetic things. It's a chapter in The Same and Not the Same. And it was, so I gave that talk, and there was a, they were going to, yeah, and the rector's office said, Shira Leibowitz is going to help you. I didn't need any help, but they wanted to publish the talk. So she was translating it into Hebrew. And she said, you know, there is a discussion in the rabbinical literature. So I met her, and she was clearly an observant woman. She wore a scarf and modest clothing, and I knew the last name vaguely. She said there are some things in the rabbinical literature about natural, unnatural, though the discussion is mostly, we started talking, and we decided to write an article about it. So we wrote about an article. I don't know where it's published. It's published in some literary journal about natural, unnatural, with stories from rabbinical literature. And we added some others. I found out that she was married to a son of Yeshayahu Leibowitz, was a biochemist and a maverick, religious authority, but also a very good chemist. He's no longer alive. And his sister was Nechama Leibowitz. Both Yeshayahu and Nechama were people of the Buber Sholem generation. They were German trained in philosophy, in the case of Yeshayahu Nechama, and then went to Israel. Neither of them is alive. Nechama is the author of some psychologically perceptive, very perceptive commentaries on the Bible that many people know. So Shira was an American who married into that family. Shira was a science groupie. She had an engineering degree, never practiced, but she loved science. At the same time, she was very aggressively religious, but in a rather leftist religious family, if you can imagine that, which is what she was in. Totally different mentality from the settlers in the West Bank, let's say. Those. Anyway, I found, we then planned a book eventually, and we wrote that book over in the 90s, early 90s. And meanwhile, Shira's husband died. She remarried. There's a comical story of finding a husband for her. And her second husband was one of the worst American Jew-turned-religious, returned there. And he was of the West Bank settlers mentality. And it wasn't clear for a while that we could finish the book because it wasn't obvious within the tradition that she moved that wives write books. Hmm. We worked all the time with the door open, so to maintain proper modesty in that environment. But we had to worry about assorted things there, which sound humorous, but when we went looking for the snails that produce indigo, I went in the water with her sons. But she wouldn't go into the water to look for the snails. And when we came out, there was a picture. Someone took a photograph of me holding some of the snails that produce the snail indigo, which is Tyrian purple. And this picture of Shira in her modest dress and of me, and we're both smiling. I'm holding it. And I'm in a t-shirt with my nipples showing through the shirt, and it was cold, and I'm in shorts, and we're both smiling now, since collaboration in a book is not an act that induces smiling very often. It does, actually, but it's hard to get both authors smiling. So we had a picture. I said, we've got to use this on the back cover of a book. And she said, I have to ask my rabbi. So I went, I said, Shira, what is it? Is it my nipples showing through? And she said, well, I don't know. You just don't look presentable. And I wasn't wearing Speedo. I wasn't wearing a risque bathing suit or anything. I was wearing. Well, it turns out it was my naked knees showing. So we cut off the picture at the waist, and then we could have it. So that was part of the stories. But anyway, it was a rare book, a testimony to the divisiveness of the religious situation in Israel. Was that book was not translated into Hebrew. Mm. No publisher would touch it. Been translated into Spanish and Italian because the division between the secular and the religious in Israel is great, and it's one of the hidden dichotomy. It's not hidden, it's a dichotomy in Israeli society, exacerbated by that the religious don't serve in the military. Just to show you, Shira's two eldest sons were both served in the military. There is more and more Orthodox in the military. But they refused to serve on the West Bank. And one of them was imprisoned mm-hmm. for disobeying orders. So it's... Anyway, we wrote that book as I learned a tremendous amount. I couldn't know, I knew Hebrew, but the Talmud is written part in Hebrew and part in Aramaic. And the Aramaic was too much, and I didn't have enough time to learn. I didn't feel that comfortable with the Hebrew either, so I read it in translation. But there are good translations now. There have been good translations for 150 years. Anyway, I learned a lot about Jewish tradition in the process. Basically, I seem to be able to think the way that the religious think, in particular the way the Talmudic scholars think. So I could work myself into a mind frame of the religious. I feel the same way, incidentally, about other religious traditions with a scholarly tradition. So, the Catholic tradition has that minds has that it's 2 millennia's worth of scholarly commentary on everything, and it's very interesting. And I found in another context, for instance, I had to give a talk to Yeshiva University, a place where people study for to be rabbis, but also secular studies. They had them read Bertolt Brecht's The Life of Galileo one day, the whole incoming freshman class, to stimulate a discussion at this Jewish religious university about science and religion. So I read the Brecht, and I had a lecture to construct with them, but I not only read the Brecht, but I also told them about. After you find out about Brecht, first of all, how he exploited women to write those plays, and second, how that particular play was changed several times in response to his shifting politics and to response to Soviet propaganda. Okay, I told him about that, but I also looked back in... Galileo's life, some writing, and I found in, I think, Santillana, I found this passage from Cardinal Bernardini. Anyway, I looked, a little bit in the correspondence in the church around Galileo. And a Jesuit priest asked Cardinal Bernardini, what should we believe about the Copernican tradition? And Bernardini answers this remarkable letter, which essentially says that if the proofs were in that Copernicus and Galileo were right, the church would adjust. But the proofs are not in, he says. He was wrong. But he makes actually a reasonable scientific argument. And within, once you establish a tradition of scholarship, you get interesting things. And I think the Catholic Church is like that. So I digress a little bit, but I just want to make the point that I can empathize with the religious ways of thinking. So I also like ritual, so that I have an inherent sympathy for religious traditions. Mm-hmm. When I wrote the book From Shira, people, in fact, Jewish friends of mine who were religious, interpreted my sympathy expressed in various ways for that tradition to attempt to convert me back to observance. And there's no way I would go there. Mm-hmm. But what they didn't realize was I wrote with such sympathy about the feeling of for the ritual. But I have the same feeling when I go to Afro-Brazilian possession rites. I get the same feeling when I experience Santeria in the Caribbean. There is something going on there which is very interesting, and I feel it. I feel also being in a synagogue, and when I go to a mass, I feel it too. So, anyway, I learned a lot about my own tradition, tremendous amount. And in some way, I became more Jewish as a result, maybe. And I'm still that way. And I'm very Jewish in my own interpretation of it, which does not include a religious observance, but with a great respect for that tradition which I come from.
I have two other topics that I just wanted to touch on, and I think we should have enough time.
Then we'll have to stop.
You did start to tell us a little bit about the origins of the play Oxygen. So
yes.
I'd just like to hear a little bit more about that, working with Carl Girossi, especially in light of his passing recently.
So the origins, the thing I told you was that in chemistry imagined you can see an essay called The Air of Revolution, which traces the essence of it. And I noted the irony there, which is not for the play necessarily, but that here is Lavoisier, the conservative, though he didn't work against the revolution, but given his background and that he was a banker, he was politically conservative. Here he is, the chemical revolutionary, while Priestley, the political and religious radical, turns out to be the scientific, though a discoverer, turns out to be believing phlogiston. That was interesting. The makings of the play were there, except they were in another place, so that there's a dramatic situation. To me, the dramatic situation, which I mentioned to Carl, and which was behind our first attempt to write the play, was of Lavoisier in 1774 in September at home. And the week before, Priestley has come to have dinner with him, and he hears Priestley has made this new air in which splint flares up and mice live longer. And Lavoisier needed that, but he hadn't. He knew that things burned in air up to a certain point, phosphorus and oxygen in air, and then it stopped burning. And then, but he hadn't quite pushed himself through to isolating oxygen. The same week, according to our best estimates, within a week of that dinner with Priestley, Lavoisier gets the letter from Scheele that says that Scheele has made this air. And he asked Lavoisier to do the experiment. He'd have a pretty aggressive letter. He's asking essentially Lavoisier to prove that he, Scheele, was right. But I'm thinking about Lavoisier at home, and here is, he's the only guy who understands this, and these other two guys discover this thing. And I think he thinks about how he should deal with it. So the answer it is, he doesn't deal with it very well. He tries to take the discovery away from Priestley by recreating the experiment. He gives Priestley grudging credit. Priestley objects. Priestley's not going to be kept quiet in this. Eventually gives him grudging credit. And Scheele's letter, he doesn't answer. Huh. He doesn't answer. I believe, unlike what we have in the play, I think he saw it, really. Why didn't he answer it? I don't know. Lavoisier is an imperfect person. But anyway, I thought the dramatic situation was Lavoisier weighing what to do. But weighing what to do doesn't translate immediately into drama. So that scene never found its way in a play, though it was initially so. So I have this idea this might be a dramatic situation. It flits through my mind it could be a play. I do nothing about it. Until one day I meet Carl Gerasi around, the book with Vivian is around, I don't know, 93, I think. I meet Gerasi around 97, something like that, and I tell him this story, and I think, and I had heard, Carl had written his first play, An Immaculate Misconception. I tell him this story, I don't know where we met, and he says, let's write a play about it. I say, sure. And from then on, he's pushing to write the play, and he's very energetic and plans things. We meet one more time, actually, in a New York hotel, and we start out. He drafts a prenuptial agreement for our play. We agree his name will go first. And prenuptial agreement has, among other things, it has something like all the funds received will go into a certain joint account. But it also has a, if there is a dispute about something, that we will mutually agree on some theatrical expert who will resolve the dispute. We actually invoke that mechanism once or twice later on, but most of the time I just, as I just said at the Gerasi Memorial when it evoked a laugh, most of the time when there's a serious disagreement, and there were some, I asked him to have his wife decide, because I knew his wife was strong enough to tell him off from some other, Diane Middlebrook, she's a literary critic, she knows things well. And I was right.
What were some of the things that you disagreed about?
So the things we disagree about are, and it's difficult, the two things that in writing any sort of creative fiction or a play, poem, the two people going to disagree with are humor and pathos. So what one person thinks is funny and the other person is not going to think is funny. And pathos, I mean evoking emotion, in the sense, what one person thinks pulls on the heartstrings, the next person thinks is maudlin, is too much. And we had some such disagreements. And some of them, But we worked together. We had only one prolonged period together of 10 days in London, where I was in his apartment, and we divided up scenes, and we had some pressure of a possible production. Having Gerassi as a theatrical agent helps a lot, because he applied to the task the same skills that made him a good businessman. He badgered people incessantly to produce things, and he pushed them and pushed them. And there were disagreements of some sort, and I didn't like the way he pushed them. But also behind the pushing, there is money, and he had some funds to help produce these things. As usual in business, these are not, it's not that he necessarily agreed to pay for the production. Mm-hmm. There are other ways. He would agree to sponsor the production of something else in order that this be produced. It's like companies avoid taxes. They don't just, they find ways. It helped to have Gerassi as a co-worker, but after that we went our own ways. I've written two. He was single-mindedly devoted to the plays, and mainly, but also to fiction and non-fiction. And I decided to keep on with the science, but I've kept these other things, and I've written two plays since. I have had much less success in having these staged because I have not had Carl as a business manager. he was phenomenal. He was ego incarnate, and though he complained about having to push himself forward all the time, he loved it. He, at the same time, was brutally honest about that, about pushing himself forward, and also about the play and about other things. He was very, very honest. He was not easy to work with because we're different personalities on this, on the ego side, and also that pushing was very difficult for me to do. And all the things that had to do along with that. But he did get it done, and he had various maneuvers to keep his books. He believed that it didn't matter who the publisher was, you got the book published that helped the next book, that helped the production of the play and so on. And I just didn't have that kind of feeling about things. The facts are we didn't work on any other play, and there wasn't even the thought of doing so. But we came out of this. What helped was there was a lot of mutual respect for, based in part on the science, of course, the scientific history. And I've also, the sight of Gerassi, I went to that artist colony, so I had that connection. I really think one of his great achievements unsung is with pushing science forward in Latin and in South America. He trained generations of Brazilian chemists, and in Mexico, just the idea of having a major company doing research in Mexico did wonders for Mexican chemists and for chemical industry. So many South American chemists were postdocs with Gerassi. He had a great influence. There was also a very important National Academy of Sciences report that he did in the mid-60s on science in South America. A remarkable person.
So the last thing I wanted to talk about, and you know, I fully realized that Carsten and I got to hear an hour-long talk about this.
Yes, you can
night,
use
so,
that as part of the interview. Just incorporate that.
But you also did mention when we spoke during the first part of the interview a few months back, the consequences, or I'm framing this as, you know, the art of science. You were talking a bit about the consequences of paper drawings in relation to 3D crystal structures and new ways of visualizing things. And I was just wondering if there is something you can say in the short amount of time that we have left about those sorts of, that very broad issue.
Well, as I made it clear, drawing molecules, and in my case, adding to that the drawing of orbitals, has been essential to chemistry. There is the other part of science, it's measurements, spectra, let's say, and the methods of structure determination and of separation are what's made modern chemistry, organic and inorganic. But drawing molecules, drawing the microscopic things, and by whatever means possible, is meaning by hand. And it's interesting that Alan Rock traces these, calculate in 5 years, drawing benzene in six different ways. He's playing. Kekulé is very much a man after my own heart. I mean, he's playing. He's a heroic figure. He's playing with these representations. Trying. So interesting. Drawing molecules is very important. You find chemists sketching molecules all the time during seminars and things like that. We learn how to do it. I was joking about that we're not talented at doing it. We learn how to do to use this particular method of representation. I mentioned ChemDraw and the revolution that it's made in representing molecules. The pictures that we represent have interest. I've written elsewhere about the relationship of them to caricature, which is another medium where essence of motion, actually, of gestures, is captured in a few strokes of a pen. There's a relationship to primitive drawings, to Eskimo or other culture drawings. There is a thing that Pierre Laszlo and I have written about interests, a relationship to cubist representation. You emphasize a piece of the molecule. That's me saying alarm, 1220. I just want to stop the alarm.
Sure.
It's very important. It's changing. Computers have changed it. So that technology I described. India ink on tracing paper is gone. Technology is distance, but I demand more of my students to produce pictures of molecules immediately in their discussions with me. And they all master under my pressure, I guess, to do so, then providing me with rep. So there are various programs for representing extended structures, which are more difficult than individual molecules. We somehow have mastered this. I think it's changing. I think it becomes still an essential part of chemistry. We recently had our first 3D printed model of a benzene crystal, which we're interested how benzene forms under pressure. It's changing. I think if 3D printing becomes cheaper, which it will, people will make models again in substantial volume. And I think the virtual reality is a little bit longer off, but it's going to come into chemistry eventually too. I don't know what else to say about this. It interests me, this tactile visual link. I've tried to sometimes talk to some psychologists trying to get them interested in it, but I haven't found the right one to write something about that. Mm-hmm. I'd like to find other evidence for that link. Mm-hmm. No amount of simulation of reality is going to replace the real thing. That's in part the element about pornography. Is pornography spoiling sexual experience for our young people? They're exposed to much more. The actual act of making love is so much more involved than any simulation you can imagine, that it's going to remain something, both a source of tension and concern for our teenagers and a part of discovering the world in interesting ways. So it's going to be it's different.
What is the real thing in chemistry for a theoretician?
For me, it is still the molecule and the orbitals, and I see those orbitals as little volumes which are represented by I see them two-dimensional, but I can put them into sort of three-dimensional, but I see them largely two-dimensional. So is the output in the paper is a wave function in term which has a list of components, maybe 50 to 100 terms long, which is a contribution of a certain exponential function with a certain exponent, e to the minus kr, and there's some coefficient times that, but another coefficient plus this all. So we had that from the beginning in the extended Hickel method, and I learned to truncate it, throw away the small parts, don't sweat the small stuff, look at the big one and draw it out as a symbol. And the program would draw it out too, what the program put out had too much information in it still for the drawing of the orbital. So I simplified the orbital to its essential component. But in the beginning, they didn't have the graphics program, so my facility with these orbitals was honed during a time where I had to look at the number on these 11 by 14 accordion sheets of stuff which were spewed out for the computer. And I looked at the numbers, truncated in my mind, looked at the biggest component, sketched it on a piece of paper. So there, in that process, I was honing my reduction of, I was moving toward the explanation. I was reducing the information content, throwing away most of it, keeping the essential part and translating it into a picture. Those are the keys to my forming the explanation. And then I had a facility with words around it. So that what I wrote about it then was convincing in some way, and somehow I learned how to make people feel it, that it mattered to me, so it mattered to them. How to make people feel it without, that the action of sharing with them is an act of sharing and giving rather than an act of reaffirming ego. That, I don't know if I can teach anyone, though we try the students, but there is a difference. The receiver perceives that difference in action. To me, the moment I understood it, I could teach it. And I applied the same pedagogic strategies. Okay, we're going to have to stop.
Thank you very much.
Any more?
Thanks.
We roamed over.